wondering if there's some way that we can kind of share that.
Members of the court, when I heard about this, I accepted the invitation to come to Minden because I happened to have grown up 20 miles south of here, and my fifth grade teacher, if she would have thought I ever would have appeared before the Nebraska Supreme Court, case would have been Captain State versus Gerald Susie. I spent the entire fifth grade essentially in detention battling with her, and the way she kind of turned me around was word problems. And word problems were a math problem, and I just loved it. I mean, it ended up turning me around, and I realized when I did all of that, that what I have here today is a math problem. And the question is, a math problem is, what is it that you're trying to find out? And with these three sentences, the question is, how much time can the state of Nebraska require Justine Williams to serve on each of the individual sentences? And then, if they're combined, how much can the state of Nebraska require her to serve? That's the question. And when you do that, it struck me that there are two ways that you can try and add these together. And that's what this chart is about.
Mr. Susie, on what grounds did the district court deny relief?
They denied it because I had a stated cause of action and I couldn't get relief under 9/11 or civil rights violations.
And do you contend that the district court was wrong?
Absolutely.
And why?
Because it's a constitutional violation. You can't decide it's not, you can't decide the jurisdiction before you consider whether or not the merits as alleged state a constitutional violation. And what I'm trying to show is that in fact there is a constitutional violation because the Department of Correctional Services, in computing the amount of time that Justine Williams has to serve, exceeds their statutory authority by 3 years.
So the trial court never reached the math problem that you are presenting because it concluded that the manner in which you were presenting the math problem was wrong. The vehicle used to present the math problem was incorrect.
Yes, and they did it, and the district court did it both under 9/11, Administrative Procedure Act, and under 1983, which was incorporated. And my point is that the allegations alleged that she was going to be incarcerated beyond her mandatory release date. And a mandatory release date, once you reach that date, by statute, by the Eighth Amendment, by the 14th Amendment, you get out of prison.
What's the relief you're seeking in this lawsuit?
Well, I would like a remand. I'd like a remand with instructing them what the law really is.
Well, I don't mean in this appeal, in the underlying lawsuit that you filed in the district court, what's the ultimate relief that the lawsuit seeks?
I apologize. The ultimate relief is going to be that the Department of Correctional Services determines the tentative release date in compliance with the law. We are not challenging the validity of any of those three sentences.
But an earlier release date, correct? An earlier release date than what the DCS is currently calculating.
Yes, but it's not an earlier release date than what is required by the sentences that the judge imposed, all three judges imposed.
If we were to disagree with you and conclude that bringing this case for this purpose is not viable under the APA or 1983, what are your options?
Federal court.
Or could you bring a habeas in state?
Well, I can't bring habeas. Here's the problem. That's what Mr. Smith has suggested, is that we sit around and we wait until habeas. So I file habeas, if I'm still alive, in 2023, the day after it's filed. What's going to happen? They're going to have 30 days to answer. Then the judge is going to sit on it.
You said 2023?
I meant 2033.
Okay.
I apologize. 2033. And then, because I can't file until she's entitled to absolute relief. We claim she's entitled to absolute relief. She will spend then a year, maybe a year and 12 months. That's what happened with Barney Meyer, where I had the same situation where he was being held illegally. So then what happens? If I win then correctly with the issue I'm presenting today, Mr. Smith has put the Department of Correctional Services into the position of now they're subject to a civil rights violation for having incarcerated Justine Williams for a year longer than is necessary, and they don't have immunity. They're stuck with individual liability. Now, they may get indemnified by the state, but that's something that 1983 contemplates by allowing you to go in and say, hey, there's a potential constitutional violation about to take place. I don't want to wait until that constitutional violation has occurred. I suffer my damages, and then I got to sue the people that are keeping me in prison longer than I'm entitled to.
When specifically do you think your client should be released?
February? What did I put on here? February. It's 3 years ahead of what the state does. And what I've done with this chart is that there are two different ways of doing this. You do them individually. If you do them individually, you have the first one, second one, third one, and when you add them together, you get a discharge date of, you know, I say February, November 25th, 2033. The state says November 25th, 3036. Now, in addition to what
2036.
Say, I'm sorry?
2036.
2036, huh?
I don't think any of us are going to be around at 30.
But you cure the problem before it exists, and she suffers no damages. Now there are.
Excuse me, if we were reaching the merits and working the math.
Yes.
What is the first sentence that became final in your view?
Oh, I think they're all final.
Which is the first?
The first one. Well, the first one was final. Well, when the appeal was decided it started July 1st, 1999. It became final when the direct appeal was decided in 1995. I mean,
Let me try to tease out some of the counts and so forth. Is this correct? She was convicted on a weapons charge?
Yeah, that was
was never changed, is that correct?
Never changed.
Regardless of the resentencing for the juvenile offender.
Yes.
So is that the day one? That weapons charge.
For the purpose.
Sentence hasn't changed through time, correct?
Okay, those dates are set forth in statute, specifically 83-1106, which says that in computing the sentence, it begins on the date that the individual enters the institution. It doesn't begin on the date she's convicted, it begins on when she entered the institution, and that was July 1, 1994. That's the operative date. Everything goes from July 1, 1994, and the issue is how long from July 1, 1994, based on those three sentences and the term that attaches to each of them, can the Department of Correctional Services keep her until she's entitled to her mandatory release? That's the word problem. And to do that, you have two ways of doing it. You can say, okay, I'm going to figure out what the maximum time is that you can hold on each of the one individual sentences, which is what I did on the top. And that gives you the discharge date of November 25th, 2033. The other way I did it is say, okay, let's don't do them individually, let's put them all together. And that's what I did on the bottom. I took all of the years of the sentences, combined them, and then deducted the credit for time served, which includes the credit granted on the first sentence and the credit on the second sentence, and you come up with the same date, November 25th, 2033. And so when you get to that date, how is it that the sum of the parts, according to Department of Correctional Services, requires a discharge date that is 3 years beyond what the math shows you when you add them individually, and the math shows you if you combine them together? And by making that argument on the substance, that is why she should be able to pursue this in a 1983 action, as well as an Administrative Procedures Act action, because the threatened application by the Department of Correctional Services violates her rights, which is the right to be released once she's completed her sentence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you again.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Before we proceed, could we take the exhibit down so that part of the room maybe you could see?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm James D. Smith, a senior assistant attorney general for the attorney general's office in the for the state of Nebraska. I represent the appellees in this case. I'm going to just slightly digress on my oral argument. I did want to compliment the court, compliment the school administration for having oral arguments here in Minden. This is a very impressive school auditorium. It's my understanding it's been in existence for about 7 years. Years ago, when I first started practice of law, I did practice law in outstate Nebraska. I practiced law in this part of the state for a little over a decade. I tried cases in the district court at the courthouse in Minden. Tried cases in front of the late Judge Irons. I tried cases in front of the late Judge Sprague. They were both excellent judges. I learned a lot from them. Very good memories. I do appreciate the opportunity to be back in Minden for another court case, as obviously I'm getting closer to the end of my legal career. With that having been said, I want to start my legal argument. My legal argument makes two main points. First, the district court correctly dismissed the appellant Williams lawsuit because Williams did file the wrong causes of action to challenge the prison's calculation of her mandatory discharge date from prison. Second, this court should dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction because the case is not ripe. I'm going to address that second point first because an appellate court cannot decide a case if it does not have jurisdiction over it. This case is not ripe. Williams claims her mandatory tentative prison discharge date should be 10 years from now, not 13 years from now, as calculated by prison authorities. Her lawsuit was filed in December of 2022. It's now before this court for decision in less than 1 year. And the reason, part of the reason for that is this court's docket, as we all know, is very current. The court, unlike maybe what the public reads in other places, this court does not have a case backlog. It disposes of cases, decides them in a timely manner. This lawsuit is simply premature. Williams assumes nothing's going to change over the next 10 years on the law or the facts. And I would submit a lot can happen in a decade. And if we go back in time a decade, we have Miller v. Alabama, we have State v. Mantage, we have Montgomery v. Louisiana, which cases decided that juveniles under the age of 18 cannot receive a mandatory life sentence in prison for first-degree murder. Because of those cases, that's why we're even here, because Williams pursued those cases, took the appropriate remedy, relief, and her mandatory life sentence when she was, for a crime committed as a juvenile, was vacated, retroactively became void, and she was resentenced. All of that happened in the past decade, which shows a significant change in the law. The assumption...
What's your position as to when this case would become ripe? Does she have to wait until 2033, someday shortly before that?
Well, what I would submit is, one, she does have the remedy of habeas, which obviously it's going to be ripe if she says, I should have been released and I'm still in prison. That's obviously ripe. The other thing, I think it has to be a lot closer than 10 and 13 years from now if she wanted to actually file the proper lawsuit, which would be under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, which she didn't even file in this case. And what the ripeness doctrine requires is that there has to be a concrete legal dispute susceptible to specific judicial relief as distinguished from an advisory opinion regarding contingent future events. In other words, she's assuming nothing's going to change on the facts, nothing's going to change on the law the next decade, and her entire case is based on assumptions of contingent future events, which means it's not ripe.
So you, I think, just said she would have to file the declaratory judgment action closer to the time she thinks she should be released. How close would she have to be?
Closer than a decade. And I think this court can simply say, you don't have to say exactly when that point is, but I think you could certainly say it isn't now. It's not a decade away. In 1958, I would say nobody was expecting in a decade we would have men on the moon. I mean, things happen. Facts change. Law changes. The unexpected happens over a period of a decade. And the assumption that this court should just decide this case now, you just have to make a bunch of assumptions that the facts and the law is not going to change over the next decade, and that's contrary to the ripeness doctrine. It should be dismissed for no jurisdiction.
Assuming that the ripeness problem was somehow surmountable, what is the state's position with respect to the applicability of a 1983 action in this, under these circumstances?
The district judge, our position is the district judge was correct. He correctly articulated that a 1983 action cannot happen because of the United States Supreme Court decision Wilkinson v. Dotson that a 1983 lawsuit can't be used to challenge the duration of confinement, which is exactly what she's doing. Also, I would say under Schaefer v. Frakes by this court, alleged violation simply of state law without more does not rise to the level of conscious shocking the conscious to support a due process claim. The district court got it right that the 1983 action that he's pled, he tried to get attorney's fees under that, but Wilkinson v. Dotson just simply says that's a non-starter. The court also, district court, was also correct in saying the other alternative cause of action that he filed was under the Administrative Procedure Act, not the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act, and the APA would grant immunity to the state because all the department was doing was a construction of applicable statute court law. It's not a challenge to any agency regulation or rule. And so there's no waiver of government immunity. I would cite the Heiss case for that, which also reaffirmed Perryman for the same principle.
You, the trial judge alluded to, and in brief, or at least your brief implied that there is a remedy potentially available that was not asserted in the complaint that is before us. Is that right?
That's correct.
Would you, if not for our benefit, for the benefit of the students whose education is being fostered by our questions and your answers, explain about that.
One could file a lawsuit under the state's Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, which essentially involves declaring the rights among disputing parties. That type of a lawsuit, if you filed it simply against the government, state government, the state government is immune from that type of lawsuit. However, that type of a lawsuit can be maintained against state individuals, state officials individually, as opposed to like the state of Nebraska or a state agency. He did not file that type of a lawsuit under the Uniform Declaratory Judgments Act. Instead, he filed it under separate statutes, the Administrative Procedure Act, which under the Heist case, the state of Nebraska is immune.
And then the 1983 action that you've been referring to is a federal statute. What's the purpose of that federal statute?
The purpose of that federal law statute is to allow someone to say, you violated my federal constitutional rights, and so you can file a suit under the 1983 federal statute, not Nebraska state statute, seeking relief under that federal statute, and you can do that in a state court. Your relief could include damages, it can include a declaratory judgment, but the starter is you have to have a violation of a federal constitutional right. It's not simply claiming I disagree with the state's interpretation of its own state laws. It has to violate federal law.
And what would be the viability of habeas and when? State habeas
is viable once the person has reached the point that they should be released from prison and they're still being wrongfully held in prison beyond their mandatory release date, then you can file a state habeas action, and there are state statutes allowing a state habeas action to get a court to say you're holding this person beyond what the law allows you to do, and you're hereby ordered to release the person from prison. It might be premature, but probably not under Heist. One perhaps could make the argument because of the state habeas statute, that is your sole remedy. I would leave that for another day.
For educational purposes, we refer to a habeas action. That's shorthand for habeas corpus. Can you enlighten our student audience as to what that means?
Habeas corpus is a Latin term. When I was a law student, I used to have professors that say when courts start speaking Latin, it's because they can't articulate it in English, but that's where that comes from. But it's a Latin term essentially involving the fact that someone is being wrongfully held in custody by government, prison or whatever, beyond the time that the law allows him to keep him in
custody.
Wouldn't
the literal translation be produce the body?
Produce the body. That's the Latin translation. Yeah, produce the body, take him in front of the court, and then the court decides whether or not you should be released from custody or remain in custody. And if the court, and it's a fairly summary procedure, is supposed to be, if the court does not order the release, then you have a right to appeal, and eventually that appeal can come to this court. But as I indicated before, this case is going to be decided in roughly a year. So it's not, doesn't take 10 years or 13 years to get to the Nebraska Supreme Court to get a decision.
Before you sit down, to help this group better understand what this matter is all about, can you help us understand why the state says that this appellant owes 3 more years of incarceration than she thinks she does?
It's a combination of state statutes. She got convicted of first-degree murder when she was juvenile. she was sentenced to life in prison, and under that, you don't get out of prison at all unless you're granted a pardon or clemency or something like that. She also was given an additional prison sentence for use of a deadly weapon or a firearm and the commission of that felony, which was on top of her murder sentence. And then while in prison, she got one more prison sentence for assaulting an assault by a confined person. So in other words, while she's in prison, she assaults somebody else. That's the background. The United States Supreme Court decided Miller v. Alabama and said as a matter of constitutional law, you cannot sentence a juvenile under the age of 18 to a mandatory sentence of life, Nebraska law.
So she's resentenced on the murder.
She's resentenced on the murder.
Was she ever resentenced on the weapon?
She was never resentenced on those other two
so
crimes.
The weapons the first day that became, first sentence that became public?
Yes, the weapons sentence would have been at the same time of the sentence on the murder for which she was resentenced. The assault on a confined person was later. Then it gets into the issues of how you construe the statutes on
but
consolidating sentences.
LB 191 and 250, whatever.
No.
But I'm just trying to hear what the state believes is day one for doing a proper
well,
calculation.
What I would say as a matter of law, the district court never decided that substantive issue because the wrong vehicle was used to try to address it. And I think that would be a matter if the court disagrees with my argument and sends it back to the district court, then it's up to the district court to address that substantive issue, which it never decided. So I'm not going to presuppose what the district court should do, nor would
Well, hypothetically, if you were going to presuppose, what would your argument be?
My argument would be I'd refer to Schaefer v. Gable, in which you consolidate all of those sentences, because essentially what the defendant is trying to do is the same thing the defendant tried to do in Schaefer v. Gable, and that's eliminate those other prison sentences and get credit for time served twice. And essentially say, I got resentenced to life, I got all the credit for time served back to when I was first arrested for that murder case, and then all of these other two crimes should just disappear and go away, and so I get credit for time served twice. That's what happened in Schaefer v. Gable, and this court said, no, you can't do that. I don't know if the court has further questions. I would conclude by, one, asking that the court simply dismiss the case because it's not ripe, and the alternative, if the court's not going to do that, I would ask that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Soucy, we gave Mr. Smith quite a bit of extra time. We'll give you a minute and a half if you want to rebut.
Number one, I have never, ever said that the mandatory discharge date, the tentative discharge date, means he has to get out of prison at that time. If she violates rules, if she loses good time, that can be extended. The problem is when establishing the tentative release date triggers other parts of the statutes regarding how she will be housed, when she becomes eligible for parole, when she's eligible to move from NCCW to community corrections. So it's a big deal to wait for whatever the Goldilocks period of time is when it's proper to raise this.
Would it be possible, for example, if this triggers eligibility for parole, would it be possible for you to bring the lawsuit at that point in time?
Well, she's not eligible. If she's eligible for parole, I think this lady's going to make parole compared to what the other juveniles are. But she's not eligible for parole right now.
But can you not calculate a time that you think she would be eligible if the sentence were computed the way you would like it to be computed?
If it was computed the way I think it needs to be computed, she'd been parole eligible in 2016. We're a little late, all right? But I know that I can't allege parole eligibility as being a constitutional violation. I have to go after the mandatory release date because parole is a discretionary matter, even if the number's wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Williams versus Frakes, and that therefore concludes our arguments for today. So the court is adjourned, and you may, counsel, you may stay around. We're going to have questions and answers.